From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Faith Middleton, and this is Fresh Air. I'm here while Terry Gross is on vacation. Today, I speak with David Brinkley, one of America's best-known and most respected television journalists. Brinkley's just written a book about working in Washington before it became the seat of international power. Also today, I speak with Cleve Jones. He organized the creation of a giant quilt crafted by friends and relatives of people who died of AIDS. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the recording of Rodin Chedrin's opera, The Lady with the Lapdog. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg explains the controversy over the place of classic literature in the curriculum. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. David Brinkley has spent 40 years in the news business, including the last seven as host of ABC's This Week with David Brinkley. The show has become a favorite with Sunday morning TV news junkies. Brinkley's clipped, sardonic style combined with his ready sense of history have earned him, along with a loyal following, 10 Emmys and 3 Peabody Awards. TV critic Tom Shales has written that Brinkley is widely considered the best writer of news copy for TV there has ever been. In 1956, Brinkley joined Chet Huntley to anchor NBC's Evening News. Now, those were the early days of television news, and the Huntley-Brinkley Report was a major force in defining the format. The show was on for 14 years. David Brinkley stayed on to co-anchor the NBC Nightly News with John Chancellor. Now, Brinkley's latest endeavor is a book called Washington Goes to War, the extraordinary story of the transformation of a city and a nation. It's a look at our nation's capital at the dawning of World War II. I spoke with David Brinkley from WAMU in Washington. I asked him why he wanted to tell the story of Washington's simpler small-town days, the days before the Xerox machine.
Well, I started by reading some years ago a book by Margaret Leach called Reveille in Washington, which was a description of this city during the Civil War, Lincoln's time. And one day it occurred to me, I saw it on a shelf in my library, and it occurred to me she had written that without being here, because that was much before her time. And then it occurred to me, my thoughts come in stages, very often disconnected. It occurred to me I was in Washington during World War II and was here. Didn't have to rely on secondary sources, as she did. So I thought I could do what she did, but do it better. So anyway, that was the idea. I don't know if I did, but that was the idea.
Well, you know, as I read it, I thought to myself, things were so simple in Washington in the 40s. I mean, simple enough that you could tour the White House and, I gather, walk right into the president's office when he was away.
True. When he was away, they even let you sit in his chair and bounce up and down a time or two and go home and tell people about it.
Recently, Hedrick Smith of the New York Times talked about the deals that get made after hours at Washington's society parties today.
Mm-hmm.
I was intrigued to learn that all that chronicling of the Capitol's social set began with a column in Eleanor Cissy Patterson's newspaper.
It rose to a public prominence then it had never had before, because she was a sort of socialite herself. She had a newspaper that devoted about, on Sundays, about 8 pages to society, about who had a party, who came, who did not, who was not invited, who wore what, and who said what to whom, what the food was, the music, the flowers, so on. And because of that, and because of some other qualities Cissy had, hers got to be the most popular paper in town. It had a bigger circulation than the Post. Post then didn't amount to a whole lot. That came to be a great paper much later. And the Evening Star, which was sort of heavy-footed. And Cissy ran away with the town, partly because of society, good sports, comics, and so on.
Mm-hmm. You know, actually, I loved your description of Mrs. Patterson's breakfast in bed on silk sheets in her marble palace. And she would try to decide what to wear to the evening social events.
Right. She had a loose-leaf book with a color photograph of every item in her wardrobe. Every belt, shoes, hat, dress, everything. And each numbered, and she would go through it and say to her maid, Tonight I would like to wear belt number 6, dress number 27, shoes number 105, and so on. Very systematic. And if you could afford it, it was an easy way to get yourself dressed.
And with all this society reporting on these big Washington parties, I gather that the rest of the nation became pretty curious about what was going on in the Capitol. There's a story you tell about a woman in Ohio who wrote to a Washington journalist saying she was coming to town and she knew no one, and how
right.
could she get to these parties?
Right, she wrote to me. And I told her what to do, told her to put on a silk dress and tell her husband to put on a dark suit and shiny shoes, go out Massachusetts Avenue any afternoon around 5 o'clock, and when you saw an embassy, there are signs on the front, when you saw an embassy with people coming and going at the front door, they're having some kind of reception, usually on their country's national day, the equivalent of our 4th of July or something like that.
Uh-huh.
When you see that, go in and say it to the front door, say something about Senator Brown is coming along. Well, they don't know who he is, and there is no Senator Brown, but they don't know it. So go on in, and you will find inside a little string quartet, a table full of food, and a lot of people standing around drinking and talking. Join in, eat whatever you want, drink whatever you want, say something occasionally about Senator Brown. They won't know he doesn't exist. Stay an hour or no more, thank them, and leave. And she wrote to me later and said she had done this 3 times, had a wonderful time. You know, you could do the same thing today if you wanted to.
Yeah. You know, while all this society business was going on in the 40s, Washington was a deeply divided city, black and white, rich and poor. Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall tells a story about those days, doesn't he?
Yes, about the dining car when he was a porter.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if I want to use the word he used, but he was a busboy on the B&O Railroad cars going in and out of Washington, and he was required to wear a white cotton jacket, a white shirt, black tie, and white cotton pants, all issued to him by the B&O Railroad. They issued him a pair of pants that were about 6 inches above his ankles. Looked silly. Went to the steward and complained and said couldn't he have a pair of pants that fit. And the steward said, no, it's more trouble to get a new pair of pants than it is to get a new boy.
Hmm.
So.
That was the state of Washington.
Right. That was the state. It was totally segregated. A black woman, for example, could buy clothes in a store, but she couldn't try them on. Stores in black neighborhoods that sold only to blacks would not hire black clerks. And there's the famous Marian Anderson story, which everyone knows. She wanted to sing here, and nobody would let her. It was more segregated than Mississippi.
What made it change?
The law, the Supreme Court, the Brown versus Board of Education ruling in 1954, a ruling that also that neighborhoods could not be restricted. The law, the government did it. Forced people to accept what they didn't want to accept, and they finally did accept it, and it's not much of an issue anymore, though we have not yet solved the problem. We have made a good deal of progress.
You know, after you went into the Army, and then you worked for United Press,
mm-hmm.
and then NBC as a White House correspondent, what was it like during your first face-to-face interview with President Roosevelt?
Well, the first face-to-face was a press conference where I was one of about 12, I guess, standing around his desk in a semicircle. They didn't use a big hall for it then. The president stayed at his desk, and we came in, stood in his office, and spilled cigarette ashes on a rug. And I was so frightened that first time I didn't ask a question at all. It wasn't an interview. I was just there. Others were asking questions, and I was taking notes. I was struck the first time I saw him by how bad he looked physically. He was then 2 years away from dying, less than 2 years. He was planning to run for a fourth term and probably shouldn't have. But there's another consideration. You could say that he wanted to be a dictator, as some of his enemies did, which, of course, is false. He had a dream that he had had since he worked for Woodrow Wilson before he had polio. The dream was to create what Woodrow Wilson tried to create, the League of Nations, to keep the peace forever, to stop war, to remove it from the face of the earth. And again, as I say, he shouldn't have run for a fourth term, but if you or I or any of us had any idea that we could abolish war, regardless of how sick we were, we would certainly try to do it, which is what he did.
I noticed that you or another reporter, the way they worked it, might get a call at any point saying, almost cryptically, meet us at such and such a place at such and such a time, and you will see the president, and you'd have no word of why or where you were going or for how long.
That was how they organized trips, train trips. They would call White House regulars who were there every day, and I was for a while, call sometime in advance and say, they wouldn't say anything about the president. They would say, we will pick you up at the corner of 14th and New York, or some corner, tomorrow morning at 7 o'clock. Period. That's all they'd say. But we would know what it was. We'd know it was the Secret Service. They would not tell us where, what it was about, but we knew. They would not tell us where Roosevelt was going, nor for how long, whether it was going to be in a warm climate or a cold. So we just had to take our chances and pack something and leave and take it as it came. The only way it could be done.
And all the editors went along with this?
Oh, they had to. Didn't have any choice.
My guest is TV newsman David Brinkley. Now, in the 1950s, you and Chet Huntley teamed up for the Huntley-Brinkley Report. Was this an arranged marriage?
Well, you can get any story you want. Because it turned out to be successful, everybody at NBC tried to take credit for it. The truth is that we were both younger then than we are now, obviously, and the 1956 political conventions were coming up. Television was finally beginning to amount to something. They wanted to cover the conventions in an effective way and to cover them from beginning to end. And they were afraid to trust me with it alone. They were afraid I'd mess it up. And they were afraid to trust Huntley alone because they thought he'd mess it up. So they assigned the two of us there, and the thought that if one of us got rattled and fell apart, the other could pick it up and carry it on. Because, you know, it's hour after hour after hour of ad-libbing. There's no prompter, there's no notes, there's no nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And they weren't sure either of us could do it alone, so they put the two of us on together.
Was that your first meeting?
No, we had been acquainted before that, but I hadn't known him very well. I hadn't seen much of him. He was in New York, and I was in Washington all the time.
Were you, feisty friends or exceedingly polite with each other?
I would say feisty. We kidded each other and joked around. Huntley was a different kind of person, you know. He was a cowboy. He came from Wyoming. And he was highly informal in his personal manner. I remember my wife and I were at his house in New York one Sunday afternoon for some reason I've forgotten. We were in New York and we went over there to have a drink and the phone rang about 3 or 4 in the afternoon and Huntley answered it and somebody, the man calling said, Mr. Huntley, this is, I've forgotten his name, I'm a judge and I'm from Streeter, Illinois or some such place. My wife and I are in New York, first time we've ever been here, we wondered if you would have dinner with us. And Huntley said, yes. Somebody he absolutely did not know. could have been anything in the world. And he said, yes. Well, I would not have done that. That's one difference between us. I grew up in the East where we're a little more stuffy than that.
You know, your style, you each developed this way of being on the air. And I keep thinking of the remark that you made when you were reporting on Khrushchev. And he had made that statement, your children will live under socialism. And you reported that the word children had been altered to grandchildren. So the statement became, your grandchildren will live under socialism. And then you made the comment, we've saved one whole generation.
I'd forgotten that until now, but now I remember it. Yeah, right.
Did the networks ever come after you for some of those wry observations?
No, they were very happy with them. Because the program was a success. And as you know, in commercial television, the all-purpose test is the program succeeding? Is it attracting an audience? Is it getting commercials? And if it does, both of those, then nothing else matters. They leave you alone. If you have a program that is failing, slipping, sliding downward, then they start calling and saying, well, don't you think you ought to try this next time? And don't you think you ought to change that and repaint the desk and blah, 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 all of that kind of nonsense. But since we were successful, they left us alone.
Well, in the early days, how insulated were you from commercial interests? I've recently seen some TV clips of the early anchoring and broadcasts, and I thought I saw a cigarette logo on the set.
You did. Before Huntley and I started, the NBC news program was called the Camel News Caravan. That was the name of the program. Camel Cigarettes were the sponsor. And Swayze, John Cameron Swayze, was the anchor person in New York. And when he was on vacation, I filled in for him. And on the front of the desk, there was a big logo for Camel Cigarettes. The name of the program was Camel News Caravan. And on the desk itself was a carton of Camel Cigarettes. And during the program, sometime, I was always required to, I balked and kept forgetting to say it, but I had to say, and this week, the R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Company has sent X thousand cartons of Camels to our soldiers overseas, blah, blah, blah.
During the news?
Yeah, well, between where a commercial would go now. Mm-hmm. And I would, that time I was supposed to pick up the Camel carton and where the camera would see it. Well, I did pick it up, and it was upside down. And they signaled me it's upside down, so I turned it over the other way, and it was still upside down. So that, yes, but when Hunt and I started, we stopped all of that nonsense.
Yeah. My guest is David Brinkley. His career in network news has spanned more than 30 years. He currently is the anchor of the Sunday morning news program This Week with David Brinkley. He's written a new book titled Washington Goes to War, The Extraordinary Story of the Transformation of a City and a Nation. We'll talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is TV newsman David Brinkley. Now, you became a co-anchor of the NBC Nightly News with John Chancellor, and then after 37 years at one network, NBC, you agreed to move to ABC. And I know they were offering a new show This Week with David Brinkley, but was there some other reason?
Yes. Other reason was that they hired a new president of news at NBC, who kept hassling and bothering me, and I told them either they had to get rid of him or I would leave, and they said they would not get rid of him, so I left. They had a person there I just refused to work for. That's why I moved. And ABC, in the meantime, had called and said they had a program idea for Sunday mornings, and they needed an anchor, and would I like to do it? And I said, what's the program? And they described it, and it's the exact program we have now been doing for 6 years.
Mm-hmm. Sounded right to you. Now, mm-hmm. That started in 1981.
Right.
When you received a Peabody for the show last year, I heard you tell the audience that your role on that show was actually much closer to Vanna White's on Wheel of Fortune.
I did, but mainly a joke. I do a little more than turn numbers or turn, what does she do, turn numbers or turn words, letters, something? I do a little more than that.
How on the show, how do you avoid getting snowed by Washington politicians?
I don't see that as any problem at all. Generally speaking, I know them better than they know themselves because I've watched a lot of Congresses for a lot of years and spent a lot of time talking to them, and no, that's really no problem at all. They're not going to snow me or anybody in our business, I don't think.
Well, there's a technique on these Sunday shows, the ones where the topic, you know, whips around the group of commentators, where you have to learn to, you know, jump in there so quickly and to get your word in edgewise. Did that style come naturally to you easily in the beginning?
Well, I don't do that. We have our little round table at toward the end of our program has four people on it. It has George Will, Sam Donaldson, and one of a number of others that we rotate, and me. And they do most of the talking. When I want to join in, I do. But normally I prefer to let them take it and go with it, and I sort of guide it and change the subject when it seems appropriate. And if I have to jump in, I jump in. That's no problem.
Uh-huh. What was it like for you to switch from daily to weekly in terms of sort of adrenaline? Did you?
Well, I'll tell you, I was very happy about it because after 20-odd years of doing the news every night of the week, Monday through Friday, year in, year out, it's somewhat like driving a bus, you know. You have to be at 12th and Chestnut at 12:02, and you have to be at 12th and something else at 12:04 every day, year in, year out. I got tired of it. So I was very happy to make the change.
Well, let's talk about news today. Do you think that there's more emphasis now on looks when they're selecting a national anchor?
I wouldn't say there's a whole lot of emphasis on looks. I would say that they aren't going to pick the ugliest woman or the ugliest man in town. But, you know, look at me. I wouldn't pass any beauty contest. I can't see you, but I'm sure you would. No, I don't think it's all that important. Look at the people who are doing news on the air. They aren't all perfect specimens of human beauty. They can't be look so bad as to be distracting, but except for that, I don't think it's important.
Yeah,
it may be in the beginning that was a factor, because in the beginning of television, we had people running it who hadn't the faintest idea what they were doing. But we have learned, and we have been around now for quite some time.
Yeah, but there's all this talk. I mean, when Dan Rather puts on a sweater, there's all this talk about it, you know?
Well, the Dan Rather sweater, I don't look at Dan Rather's program, so I never knew he was wearing a sweater until I read it in one of the television critics' columns. There wasn't all this talk. The only talk I know of was among the television critics, who have my deepest sympathy. Thank the Lord, I don't have to write 5 columns a week about television. And if I did, I probably would have to resort to using such trivia as Dan Rather's sweater. I didn't hear anybody in the world say a word about it.
No.
Except the critics.
Yeah, no viewers, you mean.
No.
Have you ever been asked to endure a once-over with an image maker?
No.
They've never tried that?
No, and if asked, I wouldn't do it. You mean a Majid or one of those people?
The ones who say, how about a skinnier tie? And
oh,
maybe
God. Oh, Lord, no. Lord, no.
Mm-hmm. You know, when the you mentioned a woman anchoring it. When the subject of a woman anchor for the weeknight network news comes up, is it your sense that the networks themselves think of this idea as somehow daring?
To put a woman on?
Mm-hmm.
No. They've been doing it for a long time.
Weeknight?
Weeknight, you know, there are only 3. We talk about anchors. There are only television anchors. There are only 3. I don't think CNN has an anchor in the usual sense of the word, but some of what they have are women. There are only 3 of these jobs in the world. And there's no reason I can think of why one of them, 2 of them, or all of them couldn't be women, but it just hasn't happened, and if you ask me why, I can't tell you. There's no real reason for it. They have primetime women anchors on weekends, Saturdays and Sundays, and it's certainly in the near future we will have them in primetime during the week. Why it hasn't happened already, I don't know. No reason I'm aware of.
Mm-hmm. You know, the ratings of all the news shows each week have taken on such importance, as you know. Did the ratings watch ever affect you personally?
That is quite a new development, Faith. Until, I don't know when, but a few years ago, no one paid much attention to the ratings. We did know if we were coming in first, second, or third. And if we were not first or second, we were always first, so we didn't worry about it. Huntley and I were. But you know who has caused all the attention to be directed at ratings is the newspapers. Every week, the first call we get is about ratings. And the newspapers print it before I even know what they are. They make a big thing out of who's first. They make it into a horse race. And it's the newspapers doing. It's really not ours.
Have the networks, though, in terms of management, begun to believe all that?
Well, I guess we've always believed it, but we haven't always stood in awe of it. We haven't always bowed to it. We haven't always worshipped ratings, and we still don't. Though they are important. I mean, a newspaper does watch its circulation figures very attentively. And if they begin to slide, then they try to do something about it. That and the television ratings are precisely the same kind of measurement.
Yeah. My guest is TV newsman David Brinkley. In this ratings fight, there's, of course, serious network competition because the numbers mean lots of dollars. And I see the anchors rushing off to host the show live at sites all over the world. Is this kind of competition useful, or is it wasted energy to you?
Well, it is primarily a result of money. Local television stations in larger markets, larger cities, are highly profitable, and they compete with other stations in the same city and by in the only area in which they can be creative, and that's news. They don't do dramas in local stations. They buy them or they take them off the network. They don't make movies. They don't make soap operas. What they do make is news. That's the only program, rare exceptions, only program a local station produces is its news program. And so I don't know if it's cause or effect, but in every city in the country, most of the time, the station with the best news has the biggest audience all day and all night. Now, I can't explain that, but it is the case. So the only program they produce they want to do is the best they can, and they send their anchors to Istanbul or to wherever to get stories and bring them back to the town.
Yeah. You know, I noticed the local stations are sending reporters more and more to some of these places, kind of taking over the role that some of the national correspondents have had. Are the national networks feeling the heat on that?
No. We still think we know the news stories better than anyone else. We may be arrogant about it, but that's what we think. Everybody has the equipment now. Not everyone has the experience and the background and the knowledge. Mm-hmm. That's more important. Let me tell you an example of what you're talking about that's just kind of amusing. The convention hall in Atlanta, where the Democrats will meet in July, is not all that big. And the parking lots and so on around it are not all that big. The last I knew, 150 television stations, local stations around the country, had asked for permission to come and to bring their uplink, that is, their satellite dish, a great big white dish that aims up the sky. The problem for the Democrats is there is not room to park that many. And so they were struggling and straining to figure out some way to deal with it, and the last I heard, they hadn't found a way to deal with it. There just isn't room for them.
You know, we're right in the midst of this presidential season, and I know there's been a lot of talk about Dan Rather's interchange, I guess some would say shouting match, with Vice President Bush. Have you ever lost your cool on the air like that?
No, and I hope never will. In fact, I know I never will. If you're going to do this kind of work, the first thing you have to get control of is yourself. And journalism consists of some very specific purposes. The first one is to say to your listeners, your viewers, your readers, this is what happened today. That's the first thing. Second thing is if you know, to tell what it means, to say that this means more jobs or fewer jobs or higher inflation or whatever. And the third thing is a little feature stories about something that didn't happen today, but something that is happening over a period of time, period. That's journalism. And anything beyond that, I may be good or may be bad, but it is not journalism. It is not journalism to do an interview with a guest and to get into a shouting match. I don't know what to call it, but it should not happen.
So even in the heat of the moment, you don't think you get pulled in?
Absolutely not. There can't be the heat of the moment unless you both go at shouting at each other. If you have a guest who begins to shout, I'd say let him. And maybe cut him off if he's being foolish, but certainly don't try to compete with him.
Thanks so much for this conversation. I've enjoyed it.
Thank you.
My guest has been network news anchor David Brinkley. His new book is titled Washington Goes to War, The Extraordinary Story of the Transformation of a City and a Nation. It's published by Knopf. I'm Faith Middleton, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with British child development expert Penelope Leach. I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Faith Middleton, and this is Fresh Air. Last fall, a huge patchwork quilt was unfurled on the mall in Washington, each of the patches bearing the name of someone who died of AIDS. Coming up, I speak with Cleve Jones, who organized the quilt's creation and its 20-city tour. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the recording of The Lady with the Lapdog by Soviet composer Rodion Chedrin. The work had its American premiere this week in Boston. And how much emphasis should schools put on the so-called great books? Language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg looks at both sides of the debate. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Liasson. An Israeli girl and two Palestinians were killed in a West Bank village today during a clash between Israeli civilians and Arabs. 15 Israelis and two Palestinians were wounded. The army said the violence began when Palestinians stoned Israeli civilians. Palestinians said about 30 Israelis entered the village and started firing without provocation. Efforts are underway in Panama to arrange negotiations between military leader Manuel Noriega and those who want to remove him from power. Archbishop Marcos McGrath has agreed to mediate talks between Noriega and his opponents. More from NPR's Tom Jelton.
Archbishop McGrath said today the Panamanian government has told him informally it would accept his mediation of talks with the political opposition. He's waiting, he says, for the government's position to be put in writing. McGrath says there are no preconditions on the talks, but that the government, quote, should know what it's getting into, unquote. The opposition wants to discuss just two things. First, General Noriega's resignation from power and his departure from Panama. Second, the establishment of a new government whose constitutionality is not open to question. Previously, the opposition had been opposed to any negotiations as long as Noriega remained in power, so their participation in negotiations now would reflect more flexibility on their part. The government, meanwhile, has been insisting that all negotiations with the opposition take place within the context of a national dialogue that began here Monday. To accept separate, mediated negotiations now would be a concession on its part. In Panama City, I'm Tom Jelton.
Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev is scheduled to meet with Afghan leader Najibullah as efforts continue to save a peace agreement ending the Afghan civil war. The two leaders arrived today in the Central Asian city of Tashkent. More from NPR's Ann Cooper.
Gorbachev and Najibullah were joined in Tashkent by Soviet Foreign Minister Edward Shevardnadze. Shevardnadze spent the last 4 days in the Afghan capital. Official Soviet press reports said he was there to discuss possible options if the Geneva peace talks fail. But Western diplomats said the sudden trip to Tashkent indicates the Soviets may be pressuring Najibullah to go along with a compromise to save the peace agreement. The Geneva talks have been bogged down over U.S. insistence that the Soviets cut off military aid to Najibullah in exchange for a U.S. agreement to stop arming Muslim rebels fighting the Kabul government. Press reports announcing the arrivals of the three men in Tashkent tonight did not say when Gorbachev and Najibullah are meeting. I'm Ann Cooper in Moscow.
A judge in New Jersey has granted surrogate mother Mary Beth Whitehead Gould more visitation rights with her daughter. Whitehead Gould will be allowed to spend 8 unsupervised hours a week with the child. The judge also barred both sides from discussing the child publicly, and the judge ordered all the adults in the case to undergo counseling to help them ease the emotional burden on Melissa. Melissa, also known as Baby M, lives with her father, William Stern, and his wife, Elizabeth. According to a new poll, a majority of Americans believe there is a lack of affordable housing for the poor and the middle class. David Schwartz is the chairman of the National Housing Institute, the group that conducted the poll. He says it also shows people are very concerned about homelessness.
Between 2/3 and 95% of the American people think it's true that homelessness is an important national problem. Almost 90% think that homelessness in this country is a national disgrace and warrants top priority toward eliminating it.
The Institute survey also showed that a majority of the people asked said they would be willing to pay an extra $10 to $15 a month in taxes to help solve the problem. Stock prices rose sharply today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average jumped more than 64 points to close at 2061.67, the increase prompted by a rally in the dollar and futures-related buy programs. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The city of Boston has just finished hosting a three-week Soviet-American festival called Making Music Together. Sarah Caldwell, who's director of the Boston Opera Company, organized the festival in collaboration with Soviet composer Rodion Chedrin. This week, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review of a mobile fidelity compact disc of Chedrin's latest ballet score, The Lady with a Lapdog. The ballet had its American premiere at the Boston Festival.
The recent Soviet-American cultural exchange was a triumph of international cooperation. For Soviet musicians and dancers, it was a great opportunity to be seen and heard by American audiences. For Americans, it was a rare chance to hear what contemporary Soviet musicians are up to, and even to work with them. Most of the music making was extraordinary. The music, however, suggested that many Soviet composers are years behind their Western contemporaries. One of the few works performed in the festival that is readily available on recordings in this country is a piece that typifies both some of the virtues and a lot of what's disappointing about recent Soviet music. This is The Lady with a Lapdog, the most recent ballet score composed by Rodion Chedrin, who was not only the festival's major musical organizer, but its featured composer. He was something of a firebrand in his younger days, but he's turned into a musician who writes too much too easily and has no distinct personality. The festival included two concerts devoted entirely to his music and his full-length opera, Dead Souls. The opening night concert included his half-hour-long self-portrait, one of the most self-indulgent pieces in the entire festival. Chedrin's wife is legendary Bolshoi prima ballerina Maya Plisetskaya, who is now 62 and still dancing. In Boston, she danced the leading roles to four of her husband's scores, three of which she choreographed herself. The Soviet Union doesn't seem to encourage humility. The Lady with a Lapdog is based on one of Chekhov's greatest short stories. It's about a bored, middle-aged philanderer who has a passing affair with a rather pathetic young married woman. Eventually, they discover to their dismay that they have fallen deeply in love. It's as much a story about irony as it is about love, an odd choice for a ballet. But Chedrin and Plisetskaya have turned Chekhov's tragicomedy into soap opera, a sweaty, un-Chekhovian melodrama that seems to be about a 62-year-old ballerina upstaging her faceless young partner. Parts of the score are undeniably pretty. Apparently, it's already a concert staple in the Soviet Union. But it's all familiar. The intense strings of the opening seem right out of Tchaikovsky by way of Stravinsky's Apollo, countless Shostakovich slow movements, and even such conservative American composers as Samuel Barber and William Schumann. Some tinkly, sugar-plum fairy memory music creates a kind of Copland-esque instant nostalgia. It's all gorgeously orchestrated, but 47 minutes of this is way too long, too repetitious, and like the choreography, lacking density of texture and characterful detail. At least two composers in the festival were more genuinely exciting, Alfred Schnittke and Sofia Gubaidulina. A couple of their early pieces are on another Mobile Fidelity CD. Most of the other composers could have used some of Chedrin's compositional skill. But everything I heard by Chedrin seemed at best skillful in the same way, glitzy yet academic, sentimental yet unfeeling. We've had too much of that here already.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed a Mobile Fidelity CD of Rodion Chedrin's The Lady with a Lapdog. The recording was remastered from the original Melodia master tapes featuring Alexander Lazarev and the Bolshoi Theater Orchestra. You're listening to Fresh Air. When we think of a homemade quilt, comfort and warmth come to mind. Also, the love that went into the sewing of each patch and the meaning of the overall design. These thoughts crossed the mind of Cleve Jones, a San Francisco gay activist, when he first thought up the idea of somehow creating a quilt to commemorate the lives of people who've died of AIDS. Jones formed the Names Project Foundation and began publicizing his idea. That was in 1986. Today, the quilt contains thousands of stitched panels, covering an area the size of 3.5 football fields. The quilt is about to begin a 20-city tour. Cleve Jones has worked as a lobbyist and legislative consultant while retaining his prominence in the gay community. It was during an interview for 60 Minutes that Jones revealed that he tested positive for the HIV virus. I asked him about an incident that occurred soon after that interview.
Oh, I was walking down the street in Sacramento, California, where I was working as a lobbyist at the time, and two men approached me and called me a faggot and a queer and beat me up and stabbed me in the back with a large knife. I came very close to dying, but fortunately I was the recipient of some of our state's best emergency medical care, so I survived it.
Did you dream up the quilt idea while you were recuperating?
Actually, I had thought of it prior to that, but during the recovery period was the time when I was able to put a lot of thought in it. I had a lot of time on my hands. And also, during that summer, it was the summer of 1986, my best friend, Marvin Feldman, was dying of AIDS in Rhode Island. And I think it was sort of the combination of the two experiences really required me to come up with some sort of new way of coping with this whole situation, and that was how the quilt was born.
Who were these people making the squares?
Well, in early on in the project, most of the squares were made by gay men in San Francisco for other gay men. But as word of it began to spread, we began to hear about quilting bees that were being organized in homes and community centers and church basements all over the country. In December, for example, I was sitting in the office and an older black woman walked in and looked around our office and asked a few questions and then left. She came back a week later with a piece of fabric on her arm, and it was a panel that she had created for her son. And she told me that her son had died 3 years before. But during those 3 years, she'd been unable to talk about it. She'd been unable to accept what had happened. And she gave me the panel and thanked me and said that she was going to go back to West Virginia now and clean out her son's room. It's the sort of project that, because it is not confrontational and because it is not political, it reaches out and crosses all sorts of boundaries so that people or organizations that one would not think of as being normally involved in the fight against AIDS find this an acceptable way to begin to get involved.
Did people with AIDS sometimes make their own squares?
Yes. Yes, that occurs regularly. We have people with AIDS who come into our workshop, and our volunteers help them make their own panels.
Has it been hard for some people to part with the square after they've made it?
That's very interesting that you would say that. That is something that we hear over and over from people. And even friends of mine, people that I know personally, have made panels and then refused to give them to me for 3 or 4 months. I have one friend who is still holding on to the panel that he made for his roommate.
What did people use to make the squares?
You name it, it's in it. Some of them are very simple. People have taken what are obviously old bed sheets, for example, and cut them down to the 3-foot by 6-foot size that we use. Some are decorated just with the name of the person printed in magic marker. Others are very, very elaborate creations of embroidery or quilting. There's sequins, there's rhinestones, there's saffron Buddhist robes. Some of them have letters that have been sewn in, photographs, articles of clothing. We've received several that have been made up of the shirts of young men that have died, where their mothers or their grandmothers have sewn their shirts together and then embroidered their name on it. Others tell about the person's relationships with different people. Was this person a father or a mother? It must not be seen as something that is restricted to people with artistic talent. This is a project for everybody. It's not a gay project. It's not an artist project. If you know someone who has been killed by AIDS, their name belongs in the Names Project quilt.
I know you often got letters from people with the quilt squares.
Yeah.
I keep thinking of the woman who apologized to you because she refused to hug her friend when he was dying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we get a lot of letters from people who didn't understand the epidemic when they first had to deal with it. And so we hear from mothers and fathers who rejected their sons and didn't reach out until it was really too late. We hear from sisters and brothers who were fearful and refused to visit their dying brothers and sisters while they were in the hospital. We've heard of people who have been prevented from holding their own children. And a lot of people are experiencing a lot of guilt and regret, and that this is one of the ways to work through it.
I understand that a few people learned of a friend's death by looking at the quilt.
I would say that's actually a fairly common experience. I'm, for example, in September of this year, as we were preparing to go to Washington to display the quilt for the first time, I myself opened panels for 3 former roommates of mine and learned for the first time that they had died just by opening the package that their panel came in. The quilt is divided up into sections, and it's displayed with fabric walkways that are integrated into the quilt so that observers can actually walk right into the quilt, find the panel that they made. We have a directory that lists all of the panels with a map that can guide one to the specific panel.
What's the atmosphere like when people come to see this quilt? And it's the size, I know, of 2 football fields back to back. What's the atmosphere like in the room when they're looking at it?
It's very, very quiet. In San Francisco, over 100,000 people visited the quilt, and you could hear a pin drop. There's no noise, just the sound of people crying. And we have a wonderfully dedicated crew of volunteers. We have about 500 people on our active volunteer file, and many of them have been trained to serve as counselors and monitors for the quilt displays. And it means really being very attentive to the needs of the people who come to see the quilt. Many people are overwhelmed by it. Many are unable to continue looking at it. And as you mentioned, many people do learn for the first time that somebody that they cared for very much has been killed by the epidemic. So we try very hard to be there for those people. We know that we've created something that is powerful, and it's a power that has to be used cautiously.
You've devoted all your time to this project, I know, and while it must bring you happiness, I find myself wondering what you do with seeing so much sadness and feeling that yourself. How do you handle it?
I cry a lot. You know, my life, and I think the lives of most of the people involved in the project, has already been completely invaded by this epidemic. I have been exposed to the disease. I'm HIV positive, so the odds are that within a few years I will probably develop the disease. And I feel that I at least know that I am doing the best that I can. There is nothing else I know to do. I'm taking care of myself, and I'm fighting back against the epidemic through the quilt.
Mm-hmm.
And out of that has come something of really indescribable beauty. And I think that the beauty of the quilt and the art of the quilt is something that really even transcends the epidemic. May surprise you, but we also laugh a lot in our workshop. It can be very somber in there sometimes, but generally speaking, we're laughing, we're having a good time, we're loving each other and taking care of each other, and trying very hard to move on with our lives.
Cleve Jones of the Names Project Foundation in San Francisco. The quilt begins its 20-city tour in Los Angeles on April 7th. Also next month, Pocket Books will publish The Quilt, Stories from the Names Project. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Let's check in now with co-host Robert Siegel to find out what's going on. What's up, Robert?
Well, Faith, we're following events in Panama. More U.S. Marines are on their way, and the president of Panama, recognized by the U.S., Del Valle, wants the United States to do something. Events in New York City, where a very tough new anti-smoking ordinance has taken effect. And we take a look at race relations in the nation's capital, because 20 years ago at this time, right after the assassination of Martin Luther King, there were riots in the center of Washington, D.C. And today, reporter Brenda Wilson takes a look at how far we've come.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Ever since the late 60s, there's been a debate at Stanford University about the required reading for Western culture courses for freshman students. Language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg, who works at an institute associated with Stanford, has these thoughts on the recent resolution of that issue.
Last week, the Stanford University Faculty Senate voted to accept a compromise proposal to change the university's Western culture course requirements after a long and sometimes rancorous debate. The new program will still emphasize a study of Western classics, but it will contain no single list of great works that every student will be expected to read, and it will be augmented by material about non-Western cultures and by more works by women and minorities. The Stanford brouhaha got a lot of attention in the national press because the decline of Western culture is a hot story this season, fueled by numerous reports about the cultural ignorance of American high school and college students. For a while this year, in fact, there were two books on the subject perched improbably at the top of the New York Times bestseller list. One of these was Alan Bloom's The Closing of the American Mind, an alternately cranky and brilliant defense of the classics as the only books that are worthy of the attention of serious people. Nowadays, though, most academics are uncomfortable defending the teaching of Western culture on the grounds of its inherent superiority to other works and traditions. Instead, they've tended to lean on the sorts of arguments offered in E.D. Hirsch's book Cultural Literacy, this year's other Decline of the West bestseller. In a nutshell, Hirsch's argument goes like this. Look, there are a lot of cultural traditions out there, and I'd be the last one to say the traditional Western culture has any monopoly on truth or beauty. But as it happens, Western culture is the basis for the common language that we Americans have always used in our public discussions. And if you want to participate in that discourse, you have to be able to understand the cultural references that people make, the same way you have to know the verb forms of standard English. Hirsch even appends a checklist of several thousand names and expressions that he claims all literate Americans know, from Aeschylus, Boswell, and Willa Cather, all the way down to X chromosomes, Yalta, and Zeus. But this argument is specious and a little hypocritical, and the students know it. As a practical matter, the vocabulary of Western culture is not part of the common language of educated Americans, and hasn't been for decades. More than 30 years ago, the poet Randall Jarrell could write that there is no book that all of my students have read. In 1988, there is not even any book that all educated Americans need to pretend to have read. I once spent an evening playing the French version of Trivial Pursuit with a couple of French friends. France is still a country that takes its culture seriously, and where the word cultivated still has positive associations. An ordinary French businessman is genuinely embarrassed if he has to admit that he doesn't know Madame Bovary's first name, just as an American businessman would be embarrassed if it came out that he didn't know what team Willie Mays played for. On the whole, though, I think we have the better half of the bargain. The French accumulate culture as a kind of social capital, with a fear of humiliation always lurking in the background. Whereas our students can't be coerced into taking Western culture seriously or bribed with promises of social advancement. The classics have to be able to compete with other traditions on the basis of their own merits, which is what the new Stanford program allows them to do.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist associated with the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California.
The girls today in society go for classical poetry. So to win their hearts, one must quote with ease Aeschylus and Euripides. But the poet of them all will start them simply raving is the poet people call the Bard of Stratford-on-Avon. Brush up your Shakespeare. Start quoting him now.
Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with sports writer Bob Ryan, co-author of 48 Minutes, A Night in the Life of the NBA. The book takes a microscopic look at one pro game, and also a broad view on the place of sports in our culture. Rock critic Ken Tucker will review two albums by Nick Lowe and Elvis Costello, featuring previously unreleased material. Lowe has been the producer of many of Costello's albums. And film critic Stephen Schiff will review Bright Lights, Big City, the adaptation of the best-selling novel about the dark side of life in New York's fast lane. I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistance from Ed Dougherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Faith Middleton. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.